This is KCNR 1460 AM and 96.5 FM. Tonight we normally have Radio Wasteland scheduled, but we are going to be playing the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, and we will return to Radio Wasteland next week.
From the campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country. Here's your host, Scott Bertram.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome into another edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. On this episode, we'll talk with Kevin Porteous from Hillsdale's Politics Department about Congress, how it worked, and why it doesn't. Michael Barone from AEI and the Washington Examiner will join us to talk about his latest book, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. And finally, as Christmas approaches, we'll talk with Jordan Wales from Hillsdale's Theology Department about the Trinity. Joining us now on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Dr. Kevin Porteous, a professor of politics and director of American Studies here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Porteous, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This in particular, we have a relatively new online course, which people can find at online.hillsdale.edu, on Congress, how it worked, and why it doesn't. And that's what we talk with you about today. So let's start from literally the beginning. How was our Congress designed to function?
Well, in order to think about that, we have to think about what Congress was supposed to do. Like any other creation or construction, the people who built it had an idea of what they wanted the institution to do, in the same way that when my children pick up their Legos and start doing something and I ask them what they're doing, they can tell me I'm building a car, I'm building a house, I'm building whatever. They have an idea of what the outcome is supposed to be. So the framers of the Constitution are no different. They had an idea of what legislative power was. They say in the Constitution that Congress will have the legislative power, and they understood that the legislative power was the power to make laws. Now, the interesting question is, what's a law? And they had an answer to that question. Hamilton in Federalist 75 says that laws are rules for the regulation of society. Madison in Federalist 62 says that laws are rules of action. And in another place, Madison says that laws are necessary to prescribe the duties of those who are to obey them and to take from those who are to administer them a discretion which might be abused. So that is to say, Congress was supposed to make rules of action or rules for the regulation of society. Citizens could look at those laws, read them, and figure out, what can I do under the law? What mm-hmm. must I do? What must I not do? Once they had that understanding in mind, they constructed a legislative institution accordingly. And what they tried to do was to reconcile two competing goals. We want laws, we want policies that reflect the will of the people. But we also want laws or policies that are in the public interest. And so they designed an institution that was bicameral, where you had one institution, the House of Representatives, that was designed to lean towards the will of the people, and another institution, the Senate, that was given the independence that they thought was necessary, while still being small-r Republican, mm-hmm. to be able to look beyond the will of the people and to think about the public interest.
How did progressives begin to critique this original understanding of Congress?
Well, the critique that the progressives laid out was I think twofold: theoretical and practical. On the practical side, they looked at Congress and saw an institution that was unrepresentative. They said all the work's being done in committees, it's all dominated by parties that are not controlled by the people in any meaningful way. Their real model in terms of reforming the institution was the British Parliament. Mm-hmm. And they liked the system of cabinet government where the executive officers and the legislature were fused. So they were hostile to separation of powers in that regard. They also liked the idea that the leadership in the government would resign in the British system whenever they were defeated on an important policy issue or vote. The theoretical critique of the progressives was that they rejected the idea that the people's elected representatives should make detailed legislation in a modern industrial society. They believed that the job of elected representatives was to enact into law, quote unquote, sort of broad vision statements mm-hmm. that would serve as instructions not to citizens, but to those who ran the administrative agencies that they were going to create, which would actually do the job of writing the rules for the regulation of society.
Dr. Kevin Porteous with us, Professor of Politics, Director of American Studies here at Hillsdale College, and his course, online course, Congress, How It Worked and Why It Doesn't, at online.hillsdale.edu. And we see some changes in the 20th century. How was power decentralized in both chambers during the 1900s?
Right. So part of the progressive critique of Congress as it operated during the progressive era was that party leadership in the chambers controlled the agenda and prevented individual members from adequately reflecting the will of their constituents. And so they said, well, the key to a progressive legislature is we need to decentralize it. So they stripped power away from first the Speaker of the House. Right? And the way they did that was they took away his control over committee appointments, over the Rules Committee, over the power to recognize members on the floor. And for a time, that did work. Now, that was paired with another instinct a little bit later on, which was, well, the president is the home of progressive legislative leadership, so we, Congress, need to kind of take a subordinate role. Now, what ends up happening is, later on, the progressives and their liberal successors realized that, hey, wait a minute, the president is not always going to be a progressive institution. And, hey, wait a minute, we keep decentralizing. We took power from the speaker. Then we realized the committee chairmen were a problem, so we took power from them. They got to the point where they thought the other institutions were hostile to liberalism, and they had doubts about their own ability to deal with or control the administrative behemoth they'd created. So in the 1970s, they undertook a whole series of reforms that was designed to kind of adapt themselves to life in the modern administrative state. And that, in many ways, not every way, but in many ways, defines the contours of the institution to this day. Now, just as an aside, we have had some re-centralization over the past 30 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
We've now reached a point, particularly in the House of Representatives, where the speakers are as powerful in many ways as they have been at any point since the early 20th century.
So the name of your online course is Congress, How It Worked and Why It Doesn't. So we understand the conclusion that it doesn't work. Why doesn't Congress work today? Can it be repaired?
There are a lot of theories in scholars and popular media about what the problem with Congress is. Is it extreme partisanship? Is it the fact that congressmen simply don't live with each other or around each other anymore and there's no spirit of comity? Is it runaway gerrymandering? Is it lobbying? Is it campaign finance problems, money in politics? And those are all interesting, but they don't look at the institution itself, right? They're not looking at what's happened to the institution. Once the progressives got their way and Congress got into the business not of writing rules for the regulation of society themselves, but of passing that off onto somebody else,
mm-hmm.
Congress fundamentally transformed itself. And congressmen have become almost infected collectively with a disease that makes them averse to actually making decisions, so that when they have to make a decision, they simply can't. I mean, it's reached the point where they can't even decide on a budget. And that was supposed to be the basic thing that would allow them to exercise control over the agencies they've created, was the power of the person. We haven't had a regular budget now in almost a decade, and I see no prospect of that changing anytime soon. So the critical thing here is Congress needs to be compelled, and I don't know how you do this, whether it's change in the electorate or the courts force them to do it or what. Congress needs to be compelled to legislate again in a way that they mostly don't.
Dr. Kevin Porteous, Professor of Politics, Director of American Studies here at Hillsdale College. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll talk with Michael Barone from the American Enterprise Institute and the Washington Examiner about his latest book, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The Reading Rancheria Senior Nutrition Program provides socialization, transportation, and free meals to eligible Native American elders and their spouses. Our program celebrates Native elders through cultural activities, entertainment, exercise, and education. Elders can dine together here and will deliver meals to those who are unable to attend. The Reading Rancheria Senior Nutrition Program is free. Discover the services available to you or your elders at readingrancheria.com.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney of Shasta Gas Propane. Our company motto is, our customers are warm friends. We are demonstrating our commitment to this motto by helping those in our area that lost their homes in the car fire and are moving onto their property in an RV during the rebuilding process. We can hook up a 120-gallon propane tank to your RV gas system and deliver gas to your property so you won't have to disconnect your 7-gallon cylinder and take it somewhere to get it filled, then reconnect it and relight your pilots. We will deliver and connect the tank at no charge, then discount the price of the propane. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793. We want to help you during this stressful time.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Signs, signs, signs. That's right, Wonderland Signs has your signs. Big signs. We do them. Vehicle wraps. We do them. If it's a sign, we do them. Vinyl, paint, 3D murals, big, little, inside, outside, every sign you could want.
Sorry, Bob. Could we sign a monster truck read? Could you do that again?
When you need sign work, Wonderland Signs is the one. Featuring the highest quality materials, longest warranties in the area, all at competitive prices. Wonderland Signs quality can't and won't be beat. From vinyl architectural to banners to magnetics, from 3D to vehicle wraps to sandblasted to murals. If it's a visual message you want to send, we can deliver. Plus, being that we are fully licensed, bonded, and insured contractors, we can install them and other sign shops can't. We even offer financing on many sign types. Check us out online at WonderlandSigns.com or come by the shop on South Market and meet the Wonderland Signs staff.
Mention this ad and get 50% off any pair of magnetic signs.
Wonderland Signs, now celebrating 33 years in business in the North State with amazing attention to detail and quality service. Wonderland Signs.
Uncle Bob, where did Mount Shasta spring water come from? Well, you see, we get wrung out of the clouds as we pass over the top of Mount Shasta. Then we become part of huge glaciers. Then we flow through miles of volcanic rocks. Then we pop out of a spring at the base of Mount Shasta. Uncle Bob, where did I come from? You'll have to ask your parents about that one.
Pure and simple, naturally the best. Mount Shasta spring water.
For free delivery and setup, call 1-800-922-6227. Or go to MountShastaSpringwater.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College, well, you can head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Michael Barone, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner, and author of the recent book, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good to be with you.
You know more, or you've forgotten more than most people know about American politics. This book, though, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't, what was the goal of this one? Why did you put pen to paper?
Well, this resulted from a series of lectures and talks that I gave, including one at Hillsdale College.
Yes, I was there.
And you were the one that was pitching tomatoes in my direction, right?
No, yeah, but my aim was poor, so it was fine.
Yeah. No, I basically wanted to make the point that I think most Americans overlook, which is that our political parties are very old and resilient institutions. The Democratic Party dates from 1832, 187 years ago. The Republican Party from 1854, 165 years ago. And while the parties have changed positions over the years, and I think the Republican Party has always been centered on a core constituency of people who regarded by themselves and others as typical Americans, but who aren't by themselves a majority. The Democratic Party has always been a coalition of outgroups of peoples who are not considered to be typical Americans, but who, when they stick together, be a majority. Both parties have faced electoral disaster and have rebounded from it to become competitive again within less than a decade.
So as you say, these two parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, two of the oldest in the world, they have come close to flaming out at times, but is that ability to adjust the reason that they have lasted so long?
Well, it's the ability to adjust. It's the ability to adapt to new issues and to new challenges and to new emergence of new demographic groups and so forth, to adapt to current circumstances. But it's also due to the fact that in this always diverse country, if you gain support from one group, you tend to lose support from another. And parties, you know, make mistakes in adjusting to this. They convictions sometimes prevent them from taking the maximally favorable electoral course. But on balance, those things have worked out fairly well. So over the last 25 years, we have seen a movement of high-income, high white college grads moving toward the Democratic Party relatively slowly but in perceptible ways. We've seen also, and it climaxed and really was amplified in 2016, of white non-college grads moving toward the Republican Party, which resulted in the surprising defeat of Hillary Clinton and the victory of Donald Trump.
Yeah, let me ask about that. Michael Barone with us, the new book, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. This sort of reorganization that perhaps we saw in 2016 in the suburbs, among college-educated Americans, among perhaps rural Americans, is that one of the more significant reorganizations of voting blocks that we've seen here in recent history?
Well, I would say in terms of quantity of votes changed, it's not one of the most significant blocks. We've seen many greater switches of votes, between, back in the 1970s, George McGovern is defeated by a wide margin, and then Jimmy Carter comes along and wins 4 years later, and then Ronald Reagan wins, beats Jimmy Carter by 10 points in the next election. That was a lot more switches of votes at that time, for example. William Jennings Bryan in 1896, 1900, very much greater switches in votes. But it, you know, this has come in a period when we have achieved what I call polarized partisan parity between the two parties.
So with the length of time that the Democratic and Republican parties have been around, Michael, why is it that we haven't seen, serious efforts or sustained efforts by third parties to sort of challenge that system, or at least why have they not found success, do you think?
part of the answer is that our electoral system is biased against third parties and in favor of two parties. The single member election district for House and for, in effect, for the U.S. Senate, the electoral college tend to squeeze out third parties. But I think more than that, the two party major parties, the Democratic and Republican Party, have presented voters with choices that have brought most of them in and have squeezed out. I mean, we had a test case of this in 1912. Theodore Roosevelt, who at that point had won a higher percentage of popular vote in the presidential election than any other American, ran as a third-party candidate of the Progressive Party. It was an intellectual trend among articulate people towards the progressive theory. There was progressives ran candidates in a majority of non-Southern congressional districts for Congress. This was about as strong a challenge to the two major parties as you can imagine. Roosevelt came in second in the Electoral College in popular vote as well. But 4 years later, it was gone. The Progressive Party has basically disappeared, and Theodore Roosevelt was back supporting the Republican candidate for president. So that was a test case. And I think, you know, in more recent history, we had Ross Perot running in 1990s as a candidate, a non-third party candidate or an
right.
independent candidate. He you know, wins 19% of the vote after bizarrely withdrawing from the race and then re-entering it. But he doesn't win any electoral votes. He doesn't come close. He runs second in some state, a few states.
Michael Barone, let me ask this perhaps as a final question. With so many, there are super PACs out there these days, people advocating on behalf of positions or on behalf of candidates, and I guess specifically with social media and the opportunities for candidates themselves or, again, supporters to reach out to each other, to be in almost constant communication, has that changed or lessened the role of political parties in this day and age?
Well, I think it's changed how the races for political parties work, and it's changed the, you know, balance of forces. Watching the current Democratic contest for the Democratic nomination, we see that Joe Biden has raised money in the way that old-timers in the Democratic Party like himself have raised. You get a bunch of rich people together in a very fancy apartment in Park Avenue or home on the west side of Los Angeles. You have, you know, they contribute maximum amounts mm-hmm. and so forth. He's raised a lot less money that way than Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, have raised over the Internet from relatively small contributors. Bernie Sanders has raised more money as well. So we've provided an avenue for small contributors to go. Ironically, the Democrats are still talking about how money pollutes the system, and we want to limit the ability of people to give money to candidates. The fact is it's changed the system. The other thing that's going on is money is maybe less important than it used to be.
Michael Barone, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner, and author of this book, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Okay, thanks very much.
Up next, as we approach Christmas, Jordan Wales from Hillsdale's Theology Department joins us to talk about the Trinity. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The average adult is issued 32 troopers that, with proper care and just a little discipline, should serve you well during your entire tour of duty on this planet. They're called your teeth. But when your platoon gets out of line, holes in the formation, or other problems, you need to call in an expert, like General, Dr. William Farrell, with decades of experience keeping those troops in line and executing their assigned duties properly and dependably. If you'd rather not be there while he reestablishes order amongst the troops, Dr. Farrell offers sedation dentistry. He and his highly trained staff will whip your troops into shape without any discomfort. And having served himself in both the Navy and the Marine Corps, Dr. Farrell offers special consideration to veterans. Let him take the best care of your platoon of teeth, and they will serve you always. Call 547-5757 or visit palosidrodentistry.com. At ease.
And for a limited time, Dr. Farrell is offering x-ray, exam, and cleaning for just $175. Call 547-5757 to schedule your visit.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. I want to share some thoughts from local 53-year teaching icon Phyllis Hutchinson about her experience living here at River Commons.
Absolutely fell in love with everything about the facilities here. The kitchen crew is awesome. The meals are wonderful. I find it interesting as I look around the dining room how every table seems pleasantly happy. I mean, they're not just sitting there eating. There's conversation. I mean, everybody here, everyone that works here has treated me like I am special. I mean, it's just amazing.
Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and ask me how you can have us pay for your move or how you can save $1,000 when you move in. River Commons Senior Living, 301 Hartnell Avenue, or check out our website at river-commons.com.
Purpose-driven banking. That's the vision behind the founding of Five Star Bank in 1999. Services inspired by partnership and defined by shared vision and goals. Five Star Bank, a champion of local economic development and community stewardship. Your success is their success. Now that's smart people doing good business. In a world that's both more connected and more isolated by high tech, Five Star Bank brings you a personal touch to small business banking, cash management, and online services. Five Star Bank, consistently rated among the very best by industry associations, rating agencies, and of course, customers and partners just like you. Your partner in success is Five Star Bank. FiveStarBank.com. Visit your local branch at 358 Hartnell in Reading. Progressive, professional, personal. That's Five Star Bank. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Colonoscopy is the most effective method of screening for colon cancer and is the only procedure that can both detect and prevent cancer in just one procedure. Take-home tests can miss up to 1 in 12 of colon cancers and most precancerous polyps. These tests do not prevent colon cancer. Only a colonoscopy can do that by removing polyps before they become cancerous. When caught early, the survival rate of colon cancer is 90%. This public service message is brought to you by Reading Endoscopy Center. Call them at 530-246-7000 or visit readingendoscopy.com.
So what's scorecard scribbling all about?
I was scared for my life at that point. I remember looking to the right and seeing all the medical supplies there, and I'm just thinking, are they going to cut off a leg? What are we doing here?
I had a coach that would come up to me on the plane, stick his hand out. I knew what he wanted. Yeah. Who am I not to give them to him? Like, I thought, okay, job security.
We came to the ballpark every day. We knew we were going to win. It's a great experience, a great feeling to be on a club like that.
Scorecard Scribblings with Brent Weber, Wednesday nights from 6 to 7 on KCNR.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is the second generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
We all had friends and family that were affected by the car fire. Most of the cleanup is done now, and a lot of families are looking at rebuilding. If you relied on a well for your water system, it's important to assess the condition of your well and its capabilities to be able to meet the demands of new construction codes. I'm Ted Ogilvie with Diamond Core Drilling. We've been providing water well systems and pumps in Northern California since 1980. Let us help you with your rebuilding process. That's Diamond Core Drilling, 275-8162.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. To get in touch with the show, you can email us, radiohour@hillsdale.edu, radiohour@hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Jordan Wales, Assistant Professor of Theology here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Wales, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Today we do dig into theology with you, and we'll discuss the Trinity and our concept of the person. And again, it's always helpful at the beginning of our discussions to define our terms. What do we mean when we talk about the Trinity?
What we mean when we talk about the Trinity has its roots in the history of Judaism and Christianity. So it's helpful to start with a little bit of the Jewish background here to what we even mean when we talk about God.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time in the Old Testament, by the time you've reached the era of the prophets, what you really have is a somewhat unique conviction within Judaism, and that is that the Jews are worshiping a God that they believe can't really be encompassed by human thought, a God who can only be known if he reveals himself. And so long before Sigmund Freud and Ludwig Feuerbach and Richard Dawkins and others have proposed that God is really just a bigger, stronger, invisible, and more capricious version of ourselves, a kind of big, invisible Superman, the adult version of a stuffed animal or comfort blanket. Long before that was proposed, the Jews were well aware of that risk. Hmm. And so within Judaism is the conviction that the God in which we Jews believe is not something we have invented, not a big, powerful thing that we represent by a lion or a bull or a bull with the head of a lion or a lion with the head of a man or any of these ancient Near Eastern combinations that try to indicate something big and powerful. Mm-hmm. He is not like the God of the Greeks, which are, I don't know, more glamorous versions of ourselves, but with just sort of larger appetites and a house that's higher in the sky.
Right.
In Judaism, this is the God who can't quite be spoken, the God who exceeds the capacity of our minds, and yet this is the God who, in Exodus chapter 3, says, "I have heard your sufferings, and I have come down to set you free." So this is the God who comes down, who graciously, lovingly discloses himself when he couldn't be known. So you have kind of two convictions in there. You have the transcendence of God. He exceeds. He's, mm-hmm. he's not antithetical to our thinking, but he exceeds our concepts. And yet this is the God, the personal God, who discloses himself. He's not just a cosmic mystery out there. He is not the unmoved mover of Aristotle. This is the God who very much opens himself to be known by others, but that's something that requires his initiative and his assistance.
Talking with Jordan Wales about the Trinity, so what does that mean when we think about it in the context of Christianity?
Christianity, of course, the first Christians were Jews themselves, and so you have this same conviction about the transcendent God who reveals himself. And therefore, the drama, sometimes was called the salvation history of creation, the giving of the law, and then in Christian belief, God himself living a human life for human salvation so that humans might enter into a share in his divine life, otherwise known as heaven. The drama, the unfolding history of God's acts is understood within Christianity as revealing something of who God is, that God does outwardly as he is inwardly. Not that his acts in history are absolutely adequate to his interior life, but they are revelations of his interior life. So revelation goes beyond simply what God has said to include also what he does. His outer acts reflect his interior life and character. And so, in the New Testament, you have something rather strange. You have this guy running around who are attributed godlike acts. He has command over the winds and the waves. Mm-hmm. He forgives sins. Who can forgive sins but God alone? Those around him ask. And so everything's pointing to him being God. He even does other crazy things like rise from the dead. But at the same time, he's talking to someone else. So Jesus talks to his Father.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a third shadowy someone on the scene, the Holy Spirit, whom Jesus will send. And the Holy Spirit is not the Father, and it's not Jesus, but it comes from the Father. So you have these three figures in the New Testament. And yet, you have again the conviction of monotheism. There is one God, who is not simply a bigger, stronger version of ourselves, but can be known only as he discloses himself. And yet he discloses himself in a way that looks really suspiciously like three gods, or maybe one god with two assistants, or one god with two appendages. And yet those easy solutions, the solution, well, Jesus is a kind of intermediary. He's an angel who maybe has some godlike properties, or he's been given a kind of... He's maybe a plenipotentiary ambassador. What Jesus says is as good as if God said it, but he's not God. Those ways of kind of rationalizing the monotheism with the belief in the God's historical self-revelation, those were rejected within early Christianity, because within early Christianity there was the strong conviction that when we worship Jesus as God, we really mean what we say. And there's something mysterious here, but we're not going to give up on meaning what we say just because it's a little bit difficult to understand. So the discipline of theology within early Christianity is described by various people, but most famously by Augustine, as faith-seeking understanding. So one has received a certain self-revelation by God, one has received God, and one strives to understand him. So we have these three, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, but yet these three must, in some mysterious but fundamental way, they must be one.
So if you want to talk about that a little bit more, so we have, again, three in one, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. What is the understanding that three separate things can be, can all be one, can all be the same?
Well, this is where things get interesting. And I'll be happy to talk in a moment about how this has also in turn affected our own understanding of human persons.
Yes.
But
yeah.
First, how can these three be one? Well, that they have to be one was held simply as a basic conviction. But then there is some information, I suppose you could say, about how these three are one simply from the way that they call themselves, or that God calls himself, in the scriptures. So you have Jesus refers to himself as the Father's only Son, or the prologue to the Gospel of John calls him the only begotten Son of the Father. And so early Christian reflection on the relationship between the Father and the Son, what does it mean to be the Son of the Father, and how can, we'll just talk about the two, the Father and the Son for now, how can these two be one? How can we be monotheists and yet believe in a distinction of Father and Son? Well, again, the transcendence of God. God is not just faster, bigger, and higher in the sky. God is actually immaterial, incorporeal, has no body, doesn't eat. In the Old Testament, in the later books of the Old Testament, God kind of gently, humorously, well, not always gently, but mocks the idea that he's in it for the sacrifices. He says, like, look, do I have nostrils that I smell the smoke? Do you really think that I lap up the blood of bulls? Like, this isn't what it's about. These are means to a further end of relation with me. I'm not actually being bought by bulls here. I'm not like the gods that devour flesh.
All right, hold that thought. We're talking with Jordan Wales from Hillsdale's Theology Department about the Trinity, and we'll continue the conversation next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
That doesn't happen to men.
It's not just a woman's issue.
It only happened once.
I will intervene. But he's such a nice guy.
We will look out for each other.
What did she think would happen?
I will step in.
It's just the way people are.
It's on us to change the future for our children.
We will change the culture.
Get involved. One safe place. OSPShasta.org/changethe culture.
Colonoscopy is the most effective method of screening for colon cancer and is the only procedure that can both detect and prevent cancer in one procedure. Take-home tests can miss up to 1 in 12 of colon cancers and most precancerous polyps. If you're 50 or older, now is the time to schedule this life-saving test. When caught early, the survival rate of colon cancer is 90%, so stop making excuses and get screened. This public service message is brought to you by Reading Endoscopy Center. Call them at 530-246-7000 or visit readingendoscopy.com.
The value of banking local comes in being able to walk into the lobby, see the president, and be called by your first name. Knowing that lending decisions are made locally by people you call neighbor or serve alongside when supporting a worthy cause. There's confidence in knowing that when you place your trust in Cornerstone Community Bank, you not only help yourself, you support the town you call home. Stop by one of our Reading or Red Bluff branches or visit us online at bankcornerstone.com. Cornerstone Community Bank. We invite you to experience how we are moving local dreams forward.
The Reading Rancheria Head Start program is a comprehensive preschool learning environment where everyone is respected and included.
Rancheria is really good. You know, they do a lot of stuff with the community and for the families. And especially a Head Start like this, they give 150% towards the kids. It's a really awesome program.
The term is planting seeds. They get more education here. So this is a great, great Head Start.
What I really like about the Head Start is they're really into their culture. They work on their language, both Wintu and Pitt River.
The Reading Rancheria is giving people an opportunity to grow, helping build this community into a stronger place. And they're very proud of their heritage.
Coming together for the kids in education, it's powerful.
The Reading Rancheria Head Start program is free to those eligible. Learn more and enroll at readingrancheria.com.
Reading Electric Utility cares about the whole community, and we offer an income-qualified residential energy discount program that can save you up to $400 a year on your energy bill. And once per year, CARES bill credit up to $300. To find out if your income qualifies you for a residential discount program and CARES program, call 339-7200. That number again is 339-7200.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Auto Body. It's been a really devastating year for some of us here in the North State. From the fires in 2018 to Snowmageddon in 2019 and an unprecedented hailstorm. Our family and team at Coachmaster wish the best for all of you affected by these disasters. We hope that Coachmaster was able to ease the stress for our customers that were affected by these events. With the coming of the holiday season, we would like to thank all of our customers, old and new, for trusting Coachmaster to take care of all of your collision repair needs. Our team would like to wish the community Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And Santa, we don't repair sleighs, so be careful. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Coachmaster Collision Repair continues to be the leader in the North State for advanced technology in the collision repair industry. Remember Coachmaster on East Side Road, serving the Reading community since 1969. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Dear friends and neighbors, season's greetings. I am Dr. P.K. Dhanuka. You can call me Paul. Chances are that we have met before, as I have served our patients in North State for the last 14 years. We live in God's own beautiful country and a very generous community. Over the last few years, we have been through a lot and we are all in this together. You have been very kind to me and my family, and now it's my turn to give back to you. That's why I'm running for State Assembly this March and hope to talk with you soon. You can find out more about me and my plan at drdhanuka2020.com. From our family to yours, we wish you and your family all the joy and happiness. Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and a very Happy New Year. This call is paid by Dr. P.K. Paul Dhanuka for Assembly 2020.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. I want to send out Christmas wishes, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year to our listeners via our fine radio affiliates across the country, including Power Talk 1460 AM and 101.5 FM in the Central Coast of California, News Talk 1540 KXEL, Waterloo, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, KCNR, 1460, 96.5 in Redding, California. Sheboygan's News Radio, 1330 AM, 101.5 FM in Wisconsin. And Lansing's Big Talker, 1240 WJIM in Michigan. Thanks so much for listening throughout the year to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We've been talking with Jordan Wales from Hillsdale's Theology Department about the Trinity. Jordan, what does it mean to say God is a Father who has begotten a Son?
Athanasius of Alexandria, writing in the 4th century, points out, well, what do we mean by begetting? And some of Athanasius's early opponents say, well, we know darn well what we mean by begetting, and that's what Zeus does. Mm-hmm. He does quite a bit of it, often against his wife's wishes, but that's not really what we think our God does. And Athanasius says, no, you're thinking about it in the wrong way. We shouldn't constrain a divine begetting to human bodily categories. So if you take away all the elements of time, all the elements of corporeality, what are you left with? The relation between the Father and Son, by which they are one God, is a relation of eternal begetting. Well, what is begetting? Through begetting, a human Father gives human life to his human Son. And so what is the relation of eternal begetting between the Father and the Son? The Father and Son exist as one God. Indeed, they exist at all, right? Because the Father is simply Father, and the Son is simply Son. If there were no relation between them, they wouldn't be at all. So the very life by which God exists is the life of the Father pouring out his life eternally to the Son, and the Son eternally receiving life from the Father. You could say that the inner life of God is an eternal relation of self-gift, in which God, as Father, is the giver, and kind of at the opposite pole of that life, God the Son is the receiver. Hmm. So here you have distinction. There's a giver and there's a receiver of life, but you also have oneness, that the giver is entirely, exhaustively defined by the self-gift to the Son, and the Son is entirely, exhaustively defined by receiving that self-gift. One does not exist without the other. It's almost like there is one magnet, there are two poles. There's the positive pole and the negative pole. If you take away the negative pole, you aren't left with just a positive pole. You're left with no magnetic field at all. And so the divine life, at least as far as Father and Son are concerned, and let's just say there's a third pole for the Holy Spirit, but I'm trying to keep it simple, the divine life is the life of complete self-gift and complete reception, by which Father and Son are defined in terms of one another, by which they exist at all. So while we exist as persons who can engage in relationships in which we try to share ourselves with one another, God exists as three persons who exist not simply with a capacity to engage in relationships, but exist by their relations with one another. And were it not for those relations, they would not exist, because in a certain sense, they are those relations.
Dr. Jordan Wales with us, assistant professor of theology here at Hillsdale College, here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. How does the Trinity help shape our concept of the person?
This is actually something very interesting that we aren't always really aware of. Our word person comes from the Latin persona, and the original meaning of that was it had to do with persona, sounding through, and it referred to a mask worn by actors who could speak through the mask. Very similarly, in Greek, the closest analog to person in Latin at that time was prosopon. They sound similar, but they have actually different derivations. Prosopon refers to around the ops, the eyes. It's the area of the face. So prosopon can mean face, but it also referred to, in the theater, the mask. What's common to persona and prosopon in that kind of ancient pre-Christian notion is the very externality of it. In the Roman tradition, persona started as meaning mask. It came to mean social role. And so, for instance, a slave was in a certain way not a person. And here we're not talking about person in the way in the way we talk now, but
right.
to be a persona meant to have a certain role, a place in society. And if you didn't have a place, you weren't considered a persona. You were still human, but you weren't a persona. You had no place.
Dr. Jordan Wales with us from Hillsdale's Theology Department talking about the Trinity. Dr. Wales, so how does Christianity change that perspective of person?
It's with Christianity that we come to think of person as something fundamental rather than as a set of exterior behaviors or a certain social role. It's almost like the meaning of persona moves inward. It begins as a mask, the role you have in a play. It advances to the role you have in society. It advances further to mean the kind of character, the sort of the interior tendencies that someone has that are manifested in their acts. But finally, with Christianity, person comes to mean the knowing, loving locus of interior life that can share itself with others. And we can see how that notion of person as a self-giving, mm-hmm. self-disclosing individual is rooted in the Trinitarian notion of God as one God with three persons, not three prosopa, not three masks or three faces, but because what God does outwardly, his countenance or his outward actions, his mm-hmm. role as God's outward role reflects God's interior life. That principle of revelation that comes from the Jewish tradition. Then that means that when we see God acting in three different ways, it's not a kind of divine puppet show where one hand is rapidly changing different puppets and one puppet pretends to talk to another, but it's all the same hand working them. No, when the Son talks to the Father, when the Son humanly speaks to the Father, we're catching there a little bit of an echo, put into human terms, but an echo of the Son eternally receiving life from the Father and being and sharing that one life with the Father. So from the Trinity, even though the Trinity is these three persons that depend absolutely on one another, mm-hmm. we get the notion of the independent, individual, human persons and that have a kind of interiority and individuality, a self-possession, who exercise their personality by sharing with one another, by entering into lives of compassion toward one another.
Dr. Jordan Wales, Assistant Professor of Theology here at Hillsdale College. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Kevin Porteous from Hillsdale's Politics Department for telling us about Congress, how it worked, and why it doesn't. Michael Barone and his new book, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. And Jordan Wales from Hillsdale's Theology Department on the Trinity. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, or Spotify. Just search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook at the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Something last a long time? Can it last if its mission changes along the way? Or would that make it something different altogether? A thing only lasts when its original purposes remain intact, steadfast, unwavering. 175 years ago, Hillsdale College was founded with a mission defined by four enduring purposes: learning, character, faith, and freedom. The same timeless mission that guides its work today. Hillsdale College. Pursue.